Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. I promise you this is going to be the best ever, one of the best ever, because I have one of my favorite people with me today, Gary Francione. He is Board of Governors Distinguished Professor of Law and Nicholas de Belleville Katzenbach Scholar of Law and Philosophy at Rutgers University Law School and visiting Professor of Philosophy at the University of Lincoln in the UK. He is the author of many books, including Animals as Persons, Essays on the Abolition of Animal Exploitation. And today we are talking about a new book he's come out with, Why Veganism Matters, The Moral Value of Animals. Gary, hello.
Wonderful, wonderful. We haven't talked in a while. Yes, I remember we
it's about a decade.
Yeah, it's about a decade. Time flies, doesn't it, really? Wow.
Time flies when the world is a mess.
Right, exactly.
Gary. So you have this new book. There's always been this continual theme I've noticed in your writing, and it's pretty basic. I don't know why the rest of the world doesn't get it, but basically, when we're talking about non-human animals, are they persons? Are they things? Or are they somewhere in between, quasi-persons? I know how I feel. I know how you feel. And it's all about feeling, right? Sentience. If you can feel, that's it. You should be treated with dignity and respect and not exploited. And yet so many great thinkers of our time and in the past have come up with all kinds of other things.
The book basically starts off with the proposition that there are persons who matter morally and there are things, that the moral universe is binary. There are persons and there are things. Persons have inherent or intrinsic value. Things do not. They have extrinsic or external value. We generally think of persons as humans. As a matter of fact, most people think that person and human are synonyms. They're not. Human is a biological term. Person's a moral one. However, we have largely thought that humans are the only moral persons. But yet, for the past several hundred years, we have believed that animals have some moral value. We're not exactly sure how much, but they have. We're sure that they have less moral value than we do, but they have some moral value. And yet, we don't think of them as persons because the hallmark of a person is having a right to continue to exist, a moral right to continue to exist, or an interest, a morally significant interest in continuing to live. And so we've thought that animals have moral value, but they're not persons because they don't have a morally significant interest in continuing to live. They have an interest in not suffering, but they don't have an interest in continuing to live. And so we've developed this sort of very messy, chaotic, crazy structure where we say, well, they've got an interest in not suffering, so we ought to treat them humanely and not inflict unnecessary suffering on them, but they are property and we can use and kill them. The problem with that is that way of thinking basically means that the interest that they have in not suffering will virtually always be ignored because they're property. It costs money to protect their interest in not suffering. And are we going to spend that money when spending that money just adds to the opportunity cost of owning animals and will affect supply demand curves? And so basically what I argue is that this idea that animals matter, but they're not persons, that they matter morally, but they're not persons is nonsense because we're going to end up treating them as things. They're going to be in the thing basket. If they're not in the person basket, they're going to be in the thing basket because there ain't no third basket called quasi-person that amounts to anything but nonsense. This book is directed to people who do think that animals matter morally, but who aren't vegan. That's the audience. And I start off the book by saying, look, if you don't think animals matter morally, put the book down. You can't use logic to convince people that animals matter morally in the same way that you can. If somebody's a confirmed racist, you can't use reason to sort of talk them out of their racism. If someone's a misogynist, you can't use reason to talk them out of their sexism. You can point out inconsistencies and things, but if they don't care about the inconsistencies, they tell you to go away. This is a book for the many people out there who do care about animals and do think that they matter morally, but are continuing to eat them, wear them, otherwise use them. And the message of the book is veganism is not extreme. What is extreme? What is really extreme is saying that you care about animals and you think they matter morally and continuing to eat them, wear them, and use them. That's extreme because it's extremely inconsistent. That's the thesis of the book. And then I go on to talk about how other philosophers have discussed this issue I mean, this is a book for general readership. It's not a detailed philosophy book. I mean, it's just sort of to get people introduced to these ideas. And so I talk about the two leading thinkers in the 20th century, Peter Singer and Tom Regan, and I talk about their approach and how they link personhood, or the idea that animals have a morally significant interest in continuing to live, with cognitive characteristics beyond sentience. And, you know, that they have to have human-like cognitive characteristics. And what I basically argue is that's nonsense. And mm-hmm. that doesn't make any sense. You can't justify it. And then I say that the only characteristic that matters for personhood is sentience. The position that Tom and Peter have taken is that animals don't have a morally significant interest in continuing to live because they don't have, as an empirical matter, an interest in continuing to live. They don't care if we use or kill them, or at least, I mean, for Regan, this was not all animals, but at least some animals. And so Regan was saying there were some animals who do care, and not just because they're sentient, but because they have a sense of themselves in the future, et cetera. And that's pretty much Singer's view as well, that if they're rational and they have a sense of the future, then they may be persons. My view is this is nonsense. As long as they're subjectively aware, as long as they're conscious, as long as they are sentient, they do have a connection with their future self, their self in the next second of their consciousness. And that is the way, interestingly, we think about personhood where humans are concerned. If you have somebody who is stuck in the eternal present that some people think animals live in, I don't think they do, but some people think they do. But there are some humans who clearly do live in an eternal yes. present. They have extreme, you know, they have late stage dementia. They are stuck in an eternal present. They can't think about the past and they can't think about the future. We don't think it's okay to take their organs out or use them as in biomedical experiments. Why? Because we think they're persons. We see that you don't have to be a moral agent to be a moral, to be a person. You don't even have to be, you can be a moral patient, and you can be a moral patient, i.e. somebody who's not a moral agent, who doesn't have agency, who cannot make contracts, who cannot be liable criminally, et cetera. You can be a moral patient at the far end of the almost dead spectrum, basically. And we still think that you're a person. Well, why don't we do that for animals? And the answer is because we're speciesist, anthropocentric people. And that's what we do. I mean, we're really good at figuring out how to discriminate. We do it for people of color. We do it for women. We do it for Asian people. We do it for everybody. We do it for animals.
We're a very problematic species.
We are indeed. Very,
and like you said, we do it to each other. I just don't understand how we could possibly think that we know what other species are thinking when we don't even know what each other are thinking. I don't know what you're thinking. I don't know what's going on in your head. And
I mean, look, that's perfectly true. I mean, we don't really understand. The problem of other minds is not simply a matter that's restricted to animals, to non-human animals. We're not really sure, you know, I mean, I assume that we are animals. You and I are animals who use symbolic communication. We use speech. Mm-hmm. And our consciousness is connected with the concepts that we use in our language. And I assume, I mean, I don't know what those concepts mean to you. You don't know what those concepts mean to me. We assume, because we use the same words, that we are having, you know, that we're describing similar experiences. For example, if you say something to me, I'm happy or I'm sad. I understand what that means. I think I understand what that means, because what I do is I sort of say, well, I understand what it means when I'm happy. And I'm assuming that she's describing my state of affairs when she's saying she's happy. I have no idea if that's the case. For all I know, your happiness, maybe your state of happiness, or what you describe as happiness, may be completely different from what I experience when I'm happy. So we don't really know each other's minds. How are we ever going to determine? You know, if we say that animal personhood is connected with having minds which are similar to humans, how are we ever going to know whether they have similar minds? And the answer is we aren't. And that this whole idea that, well, some animals might have minds which are similar to ours, and therefore they might be morally significant and have a morally significant interest in continuing to live, that is just nonsense. It is intended to generate all sorts of research for cognitive ethologists and psychologists and everybody like that, so that they can, you know, they can publish papers in National Geographic saying, you know, dogs can think. It's sort of sad. What I've concluded is that when humans have an incentive to want to do something wrong, they're really great at figuring out how to justify it, right? And I think that's part of the problem, is that Introduction to Animal Rights, which I wrote in 2000, I ended that book, or I think, it may not be at the very end, but it's sort of towards the end. I make the statement that wanting to continue to eat animal products has clouded some of the most brilliant minds in history. And, you know, I mean, it really has. You look at these really intelligent people who are not vegans and you think, you know, and yet, I mean, and who say that they do care about animals. They say, you know, I really, you know, yes, I think that animals do matter morally, but I'm not a vegan. You can understand that when you're, you know, when you're hearing from somebody who's sort of consciousness is formed by television commercials, but it's hard to understand how that is an idea that many really intelligent people, thoughtful people who have come to conclusions, human people who have come to the right conclusions about human rights, can't get to that position on non-human rights. It's just, it's remarkable. It's just astounding.
It has to be related somehow to some sort of defense mechanism that we have that had some advantage a million years ago. I don't know, because it works so well.
It's called selfishness. It's called selfishness. I mean, it's the same. I mean, all forms of selfishness. I mean, discrimination are forms of selfishness, and all forms of selfishness and discrimination serve some interests. I mean, sexism has been great because it allowed us, the boys, to sort of prevail and to have an unfair share of resources because we basically kept women out. We continue. I mean, you know, yes, it's 2021 and things are better in certain ways for women. But, you know, we just saw this thing in Atlanta, which is, you know, where everyone's talking about, you know, anti-Asian bias. Clearly it was a hate crime. He didn't choose those places randomly. And so clearly this was a hate crime directed against Asians, but it was a hate crime directed against women. We don't even think of, you know, violence against women as a form of discrimination. It's actually a very fundamental, basic form of discrimination. And it serves a purpose. It allows us to sort of continue to rule the world and racial discrimination. It continues white people to, you know, to rule things. And we all need to sort of get away from that stuff. Equality is a wonderful idea, but many of us find it completely offensive. I mean, we do. But, and I understand why we find it offensive. On the other hand, my view is that, I mean, I understand it serves a purpose. Selfishness serves a purpose. However, there is a serious question that I've resolved in my mind that I think is easy, but many people don't apparently. And that is, selfishness is irrational. Putting aside the morality of it, it's irrational. Because if you live in a world in which some notion of equality is not something that you value, you end up with a world in which selfishness jeopardizes everybody. So now we're in a situation where we're facing global catastrophe with global warming. Climate change is a catastrophe. It's not a big problem. It's a catastrophe and it's looming. And we ain't going to get away from it. You know, everybody, we're seeing it now. You know, can you imagine what it's going to be in another 20, 30 years? I mean, I'm always amazed, you know, when people say, you know, tell me, oh, you know, I just had a child and I have to hold myself back from saying, why? Why did you do that? I mean, why would you do that? If you love this being, why do you bring something into existence, into a situation of catastrophe? If we were all living, you know, on an island where the water was getting, you know, was creeping up and we were all conscious of the fact that we're going to drown soon, why would we bring more people and more humans into existence in that situation? And that's exactly what we're doing. But this is not rational. We have a pandemic right now. Why do we have the pandemic? Because the pandemic is a zoonotic illness, like all zoonotic illnesses, jumps from animals to humans. And that occurs mostly in the context of using animals for as for food. Yet, you know, we talk about about COVID-19. You have to go, I mean, when was the last time you heard on mainstream television, even on the liberal and what passes as the more liberal channels, when was the last time you heard a discussion about, you know, we ought not to be eating animals? I don't remember because I've never heard anybody talking about that. And so it's appalling how, you know, the selfishness that we have, you know, it's intended to cause us to cause certain groups of us to prosper. But the problem is when we don't think about the importance of equality and communitarian thinking, we end up with a situation in which we are all substantially certain to be doomed. I mean, the reality is, you know, you and I are vegans And, you know, I think we try to live our lives in a more thoughtful way, but you know what? We aren't immune from, you know, I mean, we could get COVID.
That's right.
You know, when the hurricanes come, they're going to rip up our houses, just like they're going to rip up, you know, the houses of the non-vegans. I mean, you know, it's an irrational situation. It's a totally irrational situation.
So in the book, which you dedicate to, I'm going to read your dedication, dedicated to all people, all of those who believe that animals matter morally, but who are not yet vegans, there are so many of you that with veganism, we could change the world for non-human animals. You are the hope for that change. And I know I have a lot of listeners who are vegan, and I know I have a lot of listeners who aren't there yet. And this is for them. And you were telling me something before we started the interview, the math that you had, that if each one of us could make more vegans, at some point it would be a vegan world, right? So we all have this obligation to get to some momentum where we spread. I mean, if COVID could spread, why can't this idea spread?
Yeah, I mean, that's an important point. Sociologists, it was an interesting study a few years ago at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. These sociologists came out with the study and they said, if 10% of a population believes sincerely in an idea, that idea starts spreading like wildfire through the population. Problem is, we don't have 10% of people who are committed to abolitionist veganism. We could talk about abolitionist veganism because it's not just veganism, it's abolitionist veganism. But if we had 10% of the population that was committed to abolitionist veganism, would it cause everybody to go vegan? The answer is no, but it would start a different discussion from the one we have right now. Right now, you know, you and I can talk about veganism, but the main discourse in our society is not about use, it's about treatment. People talk about making animal exploitation more humane. And there are all these animal groups out there, and you know my view about them. I think that they're not only useless, I think they're worse than useless, because they promote, they pimp this idea that we can, you know, we can do it more humanely, we can do it with compassion, we can do it kinder, we can do it incrementally, we can take baby steps. Nonsense, complete nonsense in my view. We don't have that discourse going on. If we had 10% of the population committed to abolitionist veganism, it would change what we're talking about in our society. We'd start talking about why the hell are we imposing any suffering on animals at all if it's not necessary to do so. We all think about, you know, we all think it's wrong to inflict unnecessary suffering on animals. Well, the largest use of animals that we make is we kill almost 80 billion land animals and at least a trillion sea animals every year for food. We kill more animals, the number of human beings who have ever existed on the planet Earth from when we crawled out of the swamp. That's a huge, mind-boggling number. And what's the best justification we have for it is that we like to taste, or it's like tradition, or it's like convenience. None of that constitutes necessity. It's a completely irrational situation. We would be talking about that sort of problem and talking about whether we should continue to use them rather than assuming it's okay to use them and talking about how to do so humanely or with compassion or with kindness or all that other nonsense that unfortunately our friends in the animal movement promote. If, however, everybody who's vegan today, you know, turned one other person on in the next year, 12 months, the next 12 months, all you do is turn one other person vegan. And then the next year, everybody who's in that pool does the same thing. The world will be vegan in about, I don't know, no more than 15 years. And so the power of one is important. I mean, we should never underestimate. People say, I don't know what to do. So I'm going to go, you know, stand in the middle of the village and in the middle of the town and I'm going to put on a Guy Fawkes mask and I'm going to stand there silently and I'm going to hold, not complete nonsense. I mean, so we have to do something, or we have to go to a save rally. You have to stop trucks on the way to slaughterhouses and bond with the animals. That is that's a narcissistic fantasy. Animals on their way to the slaughterhouse are terrified. The idea that you are stopping, just they're going to be slaughtered. The idea that you're going to stop the trucks makes no sense to me whatsoever. But that's what activism is. Activism ought to be talking to everybody who will stand still long enough to talk about veganism with you. That's what you ought to do. And people say, well, you know, that's easy for you because you're a professor. You can talk to students. You can talk, you can talk on Karen's podcast. You can talk on other things that you do. You know, you have access. The answer is, yeah, I have access and I use it every single day to my maximum ability. And I will do so until I drop dead. But I want to be remembered, Karen. I was mentioning to you before we started the broadcast that last night I was watching Mick Jagger in a recent performance, and Mick Jagger is like getting close to 80 and he was jumping around. And I thought this is a person who's really sort of, you know, he's not, he's not, my view is I want to be the Mick Jagger of the vegan movement. I want to be going to 120. I want to keep doing these things. However, the reality is we can, each of us individually, do enormous just by getting one other person to go vegan for the right reason. You know, I mean, I always tell people, look, I think it was the best decision I ever made for my health, but I didn't do it for my health. I had a very unhealthy lifestyle as a vegan. I had a very unhealthy lifestyle for many years. I didn't do it for health. I didn't do it for the environment. I wasn't even aware of those issues back then. I did it because it occurred to me that if I can live my life without killing somebody else, I ought to do that. If I could live my life without exploiting somebody else in fundamental ways, I ought to, using others as resources, I ought to do that. That's a no-brainer. And so, but I think we need to educate everybody we can educate in every context. I mean, I'm doing this with you now, but I have to go shopping later on. Maybe 50% of the time when I'm shopping, people notice abnormally large. I mean, my carts are insane looking in terms of, very few people buy as much kale and chard as I do in a single shopping event. And people always ask me, are you running do you run a restaurant? What do you do? And I say, no, I eat this stuff. And they say, you eat this stuff? I say, yeah, I put it in smoothies. I steam it. And they say, well, why do you do that? And I said, well, because I'm a vegan. Oh, you're a vegan. And then, you always get the thing, don't you worry about your health? And I always have, my standard response to those people is, look at your cart. You're consuming decomposing flesh. You're composing cow mucus, you're consuming chicken ova, and you're asking me whether or not I'm concerned about my health. And then the next question is, where do you get your protein? And, I'll reach and I'll get some tofu or some beans out of my thing.
Even the greens have protein.
Exactly. Well, the greens have protein, but we can get more concentrated forms of protein in lots of plant foods. And this where do you get your protein is one of the most ridiculous questions in the world, but we all get it asked about it all the time. And so I think that we need to educate people. And I am optimistic. I mean, I'm not happy about global warming. I'm not happy. I mean, we'll figure out something with COVID, but it's just a matter of time till the next one comes. I have a friend who used to work at the CDC, and she always tells me that the one we have to worry about is the one from pigs, because pigs are so physiologically like us. When the zoonotic illness from pigs hits a bunch of humans, a large enough group of humans, mm-hmm. it'll wipe out zillions of us. But,
And maybe that won't be such a bad thing.
Well, we have to always be optimistic.
Right. The grocery store is an outstanding place to educate about food. And I loved your example. I do it all the time. And people have so many questions because the field of nutrition is a confusing mess because there's so much misinformation out there.
Absolutely.
I love going to the grocery store. I haven't been to one in over a year. Yeah. I now get everything delivered. It's been very convenient. I'm grateful for those who have brought me my food, but I do miss going to the grocery store. There are many animal welfare groups. And as you know, I just spoke to a representative of the Humane Society, and he basically believed that he was doing the best he could do, that he couldn't move the masses faster or further. So if you were in charge of the Humane Society, what would you do differently?
I'd resign immediately. I think it's a fundamentally horrible organization.
But could you use their funds in a different way?
Look. What is the Humane Society? The Humane Society is basically, bottom line, primarily people are interested in dogs and cats and horses and whatnot. Those are the people who that forms a large chunk of their contribution.
Income. Yeah.
When Josh says, "Well, that's the best," I understand where he's coming from. It's his job. So Josh, people are one thing that humans are really good at is rationalizing their situation. So, I started working in the animal movement. I never got a salary. I was volunteering in the early 80s. And what I saw repeatedly, continuously, every single day of my life was people who started off with really good intentions, but then became business people. once this becomes your living, if you don't have a really clear, super clear moral compass, then you're going to do exactly what all these groups do, which is say, well, you know, if we only took this position, we would get more donations. And boy, think of what we could do with those donations. And we don't want to alienate people because we got a lot of people who are you know, not vegans. And so we don't want to alienate them, rather than saying we need to educate all those people and get them to understand that veganism is a moral baseline of an animal right, of anything that can be plausibly called an animal rights movement, that's what we ought to do, that we ought to get everybody we can to go vegan. It becomes, well, you know, we got vegetarians who are contributing money to us. We don't want to upset them. So, you know, and we got people who are like, you know, completely like, you know, meat eating, dairy swilling, egg consuming people, and we don't want to upset them. So, you know, we want to move the population gradually. The answer is this can't work that way. It is the case that not everybody's going to turn vegan immediately. That's clear. But the message coming out of the movement ought to be clear and unequivocal, and it ought to be vegan. No eating, no wearing, no using, no exploitation whatsoever. And I must say, it is important, and I do this towards the end of the new book, to say one of the issues that we haven't confronted that we need to confront is domestication. Domestication is wrong. We ought to stop domestication. And I know that my friends in the animal movement, I hate to call it.
Wait, stop for a minute. Domestication of dogs and cats for pets.
Domestication of any animals. That is, if we recognize animal rights, we don't let the cows and the pigs and the chickens out, you know. I mean, if we woke up tomorrow morning and we were all abolitionists, that would just be great. It would be a different world. And we would be different beings. And we would wake up and we would say, oh my God, we've really been screwing up morally. And what we need to do is to take care of the animals we have here now. And when they die, we have to not replace them. But that's not going to happen, obviously. But the thing is that we ought to, you know, domestication itself is a violation of rights, because what we're doing is we're intentionally bringing beings into existence who are submissive and subservient for us to control. I mean, Anna and I have 5 dogs. We adore them. Four of them are cruelty cases. One of them is a semi-cruelty case, but, you know, 4 are actually were cruelty cases. And we love them to bits. They're our family, but they never should have existed. They never, ever should have existed. They are dependent on us for everything about their lives. And before anybody says, well, you know, are you being ableist because some humans are dependent? The answer is no, it's not ableism. We don't intentionally bring subservient, submissive humans into existence. And indeed, when you have somebody who does not develop autonomy, either physically or cognitively, we try to do what we can to make those people as independent as we can. The problem is with animals, we are deliberately bringing into existence animals who are cognitively and physically dependent on us for every single aspect of their lives, where their existence is based on their being submissive and subservient. We need to rethink that. It's wrong. If there were 2 dogs left on the planet and it were up to me and Anna as to whether or not they continued to breed so that we could have pets, the answer would be not on your life. No, absolutely not. We shouldn't have dogs in the house. We shouldn't have cats. I mean, we ought to take care of the ones here now, but we ought not to be thinking that there's such a thing as responsible breeding or that pet ownership is okay if you're a good person. I mean, nonsense. The
okay,
best
I have a question.
Yeah.
So you've dedicated your book to people who say they care about animals and have cracked the door open there, and they realize there's something happening. I have friends, I have colleagues who have dogs.
Right.
And they're a certain breed, like one of those, I don't know the names of the breeds, but the little white fluffy ones and the brown curly poodles and they love them. They love them. They love them. And then when they die, they're heartbroken and they want to get the same thing. They want another one of those. How do we approach them to get through to them?
You're never going to get through to those people until you get them to be vegan. I mean, my view is, you know, some animal people, I mean, animal people criticize me for everything. As a matter of fact, I have learned that no matter what I say, they're going to criticize me. And if I were to tell you that I cared, I would be lying. But they criticize me and say, well, I talk a lot about veganism in terms of food, when in fact, veganism means not eating, wearing, or using animals. And I clearly have written that at least 3 million times in my life. I do talk a lot about eating animals because it's the primary way in which we exploit them, number one. And number two, as long as we're doing that, my view is if you don't get people to stop eating them completely, you're not going to get them to do much else. Once you get them to stop eating them for moral reasons, then everything changes. Because if somebody says, oh, if the light goes on and somebody says, I shouldn't be eating animals, then the next time, you know, then it's not a far push when they have to buy the next pair of shoes to not buy leather, or to not, when they have to buy their next coat, to not buy wool or fur or leather or whatever. People who have stopped eating animals for moral reasons don't go to circuses, rodeos, zoos, SeaWorld, and those sorts of things. The idea that we start with SeaWorld and we say, this is where you should stop. I mean, think about the insanity of that position. When you say, you know, you really, if you care about animals, you ought to stop going to SeaWorld. Now, anybody who's got an IQ over 35 is going to sort of recognize that is a completely artificial line to draw. Why would you stop going to SeaWorld while you're continuing to eat animals? It just doesn't make a lot of sense. And I remember years ago, as I say, my relationship with the animal movement, and I hate to call it a movement because movements should move forward and this one just moves backward. One of the many things stops along the way of my path to hell with animal people was I was speaking at an anti-hunting rally many years ago. And it's when I was living in New York. Actually, I live close to this place now that I'm referring to, because I don't live in New York City anymore. And I was speaking at this anti-hunting rally, and somebody was there from a local television station who said, came up to me to interview me and said, you know, why don't you just sort of say what you really think? Because you're really a vegan. You know, you don't, it's not a question of hunting. It's a question of, you don't think they should go to the store and buy them. And I said, I'm being totally upfront. I said, absolutely. I said, I think this hunting is wrong. I said, but I'm a vegan, and I don't think anybody, I think it's, you know, it's as bad to go to the store and buy them in a package. I remember animal people being very upset with me about that. You know, the people who sponsored the rally and who asked me to come and speak said to me, and the wonderful thing is I never take money to speak. So when animal people object to what I say, you got it for free. You don't like
it.
You get what you pay for. And they were upset with me because they said, well, why did you say that? Because that's going to alienate all the people who are sitting home. And I said, look, think about it for a second. What's the difference between hunting and going to the store and buying them? I mean, yeah, I understand. I mean, it's like there's a psychological difference. You know, the idea that you see these gorgeous deer and these other animals and that you have a desire to want to kill them, I find is a matter of psychology. Like, that's creepy to me that you would have that reaction. I think that, you know, the reality is the animals that you buy in the store probably had, well, they had worse lives, and probably that's as violent, if not more violent, than the animals that you kill out in the woods. I mean, assuming that you kill them and don't just wound them. But I mean, you know, it's not the animals you buy in the store, like some qualitatively different sort of and better moral choice. And so when you're telling people they ought not to support the hunt, and they're sitting there saying, well, wait a minute now, what's wrong with the hunt? I mean, I eat animals. And so why should I tell my neighbors who want to hunt them? Why should I tell them that they shouldn't be doing that? This is the problem. The logic of this doesn't work. It just doesn't work. And so I think that, to go back to your original question, through the circuitous route in which I've taken it, is you started off by saying you got people who sort of, you know, what do you say to the people who love their animals and want to, you know, get another Bichon, you know, because their Bichon died, they want to get another. Well, you know, first of all, you know, one of the things you could talk about is how Bichons are not all, I mean, they're individuals, you know, dogs are individuals. And the idea that we're going to get another Bichon because, you know, this is, you know, it really shows how we've commodified animals, even the ones we love. I'm never going to get to those people as long as they're eating animals. And so my view is that the pet question comes way at the end. The pet question comes when you've got a vegan or largely vegan world, or, you know, at least moving in that direction. Then you can start having this discussion about domestication. The reason why I raise it now is because I think it's the logical implication of what I'm saying, and I don't want to back away from that. I want people to see where I'm going. And also because there have been people like Will Kimlicka and Sue Donaldson, who wrote the book Zoopolis. I mean, there are people who come after me for this, and they say Francione's opposed to domestication. Well, Francione is opposed to domestication. And you know, I mean, we shouldn't have them. And most animal people are not willing. I mean, I remember 15, 20 years ago, the Financial Times in London called me up and said, we have an issue coming up about whether domestication is wrong and whether people should have pets. And we've talked to everybody in the animal movement, including PETA, and they weren't willing to say that unequivocally that pets, you know, really bad idea. And would you be willing to say that? And I said, I say it all the time. I'd be happy to say it to you. And so they've got, I was clearing out a drawer the other day and I found a copy of that interview and of that article. And, you know, they go on and they talk about, you know, but the really crazy, you know, the really radical position is represented by Francione. And the thing is, it's not radical at all. It's just common sense. If you think that this is wrong, then you can't possibly, if you think that animals have rights, you can't possibly think that it's okay to deliberately bring beings into existence who are submissive and subservient and who exist in the forms that they exist so that we can manipulate and control them. You can't possibly think that that's okay.
I agree with you. And if they had called me, I would have said the same thing.
There you go. Great minds think alike.
Okay, that's good. I'm glad that you're fearless.
I've never been dependent on the movement for money. I mean, I'd like to think I would still have these views. Many years ago, I had offers from many animal organizations to come and work for them. And I said no to all of them. As a matter of fact, there was one person who asked me to leave and join that group. And I was very close with those folks. And I said, nope, because the moment I'm working for you is the moment I can't criticize anymore. And there will be things that I want to criticize. And it turned out with that particular group, there were lots of things I could. I'd like to think I'd have the integrity to sort of say the right thing and do the right thing and write the right things, even if I was, you know, part of the humane or animal movement or whatever the hell you want to call that nonsense. But I don't know that I would. I mean, my living has always been, I've been a professor. I have a law degree in addition to a philosophy degree. So I have practiced law in the past. I don't do it anymore, but I have. I've always gotten my living from non-animals, and it's basically allowed me to be independent. I don't think I ever would have done the work I did. If I was working for one of those organizations, I don't think I couldn't have done that work. And I want to talk just for a second about the abolitionist approach, because I mentioned it before. The abolitionist approach is something that I started working on with Tom Reagan, actually. He and I split in the mid-90s, but we actually started working on these ideas together towards the end of the 80s. And that was, you know, the idea that animal, because although Tom had written The Case for Animal Rights in 1983, Tom really didn't understand, none of us did. Tom didn't really understand what that meant as a normative program for changing the world. I mean, like you got the idea of animal rights. How do you turn that into a program, a normative program of activism? None of us did. Because back then, you know, animal people came in all, there were vegetarians and vegans, and everybody was sort of in this, you know, we care about it. I mean, you know, none of us was really thinking clearly about this in the 80s. The 80s was a decade of much, 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 much confusion. And it was only towards the end of the 80s that people like me and people like Reagan started seeing that this wasn't working and that we needed to do something. And so Tom and I spent, I mean, I wrote an article about this last year when Tom died, I guess, 2 years ago. I wrote an article in Between the Species. I don't know if you saw it, but I wrote this article about my work, about Tom, what Tom and I were doing in the 80s and how we split in the 90s and why we split in the 90s. So towards the end of the 80s, we started thinking that, well, you know, wait a minute now, if animal rights means anything, it means we have to be in favor of abolition. But what does that mean? And, you know, and Tom and I had different languages to talk about this. You know, I developed this idea that if animals matter morally, they have to have one right, the right not to be property. But the one right to be the right not to be property, if you recognize it, means that you have to abolish and not regulate animal exploitation. So, you know, I started developing this, and it was very, it very much rejected the whole humane exploitation approach and the single issue campaign approach, because, you know, this idea that, well, we're going to have a campaign against fur. Well, a campaign against fur is nonsense. It's also sexist because you have, vilely sexist. And so, you know, you have people who like wear leather and wool who are pointing fingers at the people who are wearing fur. You know, you have a foie gras campaign. You got the people who eat steak and chicken pointing fingers at the people who eat goose leather. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. And so it came out very, very strongly against that, which is the reason why Tom and I ended up splitting, was because the animal movement got very upset with us. And Tom was more sensitive to that than I was. It's not that I like people criticizing me. It's just, I don't really care if people who can't think their way out of a paper bag are going to tell me that, you know, or who are motivated by money, who are, you know, motivated by bringing in contributions and having a broad donor base, are going to tell me that I'm thinking, fine, let them talk. Let them say whatever they want to say. So I developed this idea about abolition and the right not to be property and veganism as a moral baseline. It wasn't an option. You know, it was an obligation. And this idea that, you know, well, my journey, you know, I mean, you mentioned before you got a lot of listeners who are not yet vegan. Karen Hartglass's listeners who are not vegan, I have one question for you. What the hell is wrong with you? You know, sorry, but that doesn't make any sense. And what you're doing is you're putting your interests above the fundamental rights and interests of beings whose lives you are directly responsible for taking. And this idea that it's my journey. Would we say the same thing if we were talking about racism? Well, you know, yeah, you know, I mean, I think racism is wrong, but I continue to tell racist jokes and I continue to sort of push people of color when I see them on the streets or whatever, you know, because it's my journey and I'm taking baby steps. We would never do that. And so I think that, you know, so what the abolitionist approach try to do is to say that veganism is a moral baseline. It's only dependent on sentience, because I started thinking that really very early on that sentience was the only characteristic. I've developed it more now, but that was an idea that I was writing about in the 90s. And very important, that the relationship between human rights and animal rights are inextricable. And that is an idea that has never appeared really in the quote mainstream movement, which moves backwards. It has never ever appeared in that way, because they want to keep the donor base broad. So if you're a men's rights movement person, i.e. you're a misogynist, we don't want to alienate you because we want your money. And so, you know, I had a discussion recently with some people from, I think it was anonymous for the Voiceless. There were some people who come to my page. I don't know why they do that, but and they've sort of stopped. But they would come to my page and they would have these arguments with me. And I got in an argument with one of these people who was a fairly high up person in that organization, who was telling me that, well, the movement ought to be open to everybody in terms of, you know, we ought to be marching, feminists ought to be marching with men's rights movement people. And I said, first of all, I said, the entire world is a men's rights movement. I said, that's what the world is. The world is a men's rights movement. I said, but why would you expect feminists to want to walk down, you know, walk in a rally or whatever with people who are misogynistic, sexist people? And it was like, well, you know, can you make that value judgment? And the answer is, I sure as hell can. Look at what the people in the men's rights movement say. I mean, you know, and you know, it's shocking. I've had a number of these discussions with, you know, the founder of Anonymous Report, founder or the co-founder or whatever of that group, had said something on a video that I saw about how we should use prisoners for experiments rather than animals. Well, you talk about using prisoners for experiments in many places, particularly the United States, you talk about using Black people for experiments. And you know, and I said, this is, you know, this idea that, you know, that we ought to be using humans in experiments is, depending on the your social situation, is going to be in many places racist. But in any event, it misses the whole point about exploitation is wrong and we ought to stop it. And so the abolitionist approach basically focuses on the right not to be property, veganism as a moral baseline, sentience as the only characteristic that's required for full personhood, and the relationship between human and non-human rights. We need to see that connection. As far as I'm concerned, the animal movement, intelligently understood or coherently understood, is a progressive movement. It is a movement of the left. You can't say, well, it's not a political movement. Everything is political. And it's just a question of everything is. There's no such thing as apolitical. Mm-hmm. Everything's political in one sense or another. Every position you take is a commitment to furthering or not furthering some set of interests. Everything's political. And I think the animal movement is a movement of the left. I think it's a progressive movement. I can't understand it in any other way. And I think it should be a nonviolent movement. I mean, I think this idea that violence is justifiable just doesn't make any sense. It's wrong. You know, the problem is violence. Man, if violence was even a practical way, put aside morally acceptable, a practical way of getting leading to nonviolence. We'd be living in the Garden of Eden now, because the history of humankind is the history of unrelenting violence.
Yes. Okay, take a breath. Yeah. I want to ask you, you talk about in your book and in a lot of your articles, something you call morally excusable. So there's wrong and morally excusable. So there might be some gray area. Can you explain that?
Excellent question. If we're on a desert island, you and I, we're not talking about animals right now, just you and I, and there's nothing for us to eat. You're in a weakened condition. I decide to hasten your death and kill and eat you. Is that justifiable? And the answer is no, it's not. I've done something morally wrong. I've taken your life from you. But in that sort of situation where I'm going to perish, we'd say, look, what you did is wrong, but we understand why you did it. And so the culpability is mitigated to some degree. To use an expression from the criminal law, which is one of the courses I teach and have taught in my career, to use an example from criminal law, if I kill you because you are attacking me, that's called self-defense. And that's justifiable. That's okay. You know, if you come at me with a knife and I've got a knife and I stab you, you know, you come at me for no reason. You come at me, you know, and I defend myself. We think that's okay. Distinguish that situation from a situation where I come up to you, you're with your child on the street. I come up to you and I put a gun to your child's head. And I say, Karen, if you don't go into that store and rob that store, I'm going to blow your kid's brains out. And you go into the store and you rob the store and you give me the money. Is that morally justifiable? The answer is no. What the people in the store didn't do anything to merit this. What you've done is wrong. You've done something wrong to them. However, your culpability is mitigated because the reason why you did it was because I was going to blow your kid's head off. You didn't really have a meaningful choice. When I'm on the desert island with you, I don't really have a meaningful choice. I think that in situations where you are compelled, and I really mean, and you know, before we go further, compulsion, true compulsion exists only in very limited cases. And so, you know, so it's not just, well, you know, I'm in the airport and there's nothing to eat, so I'm compelled, so I'm going to eat a hamburger. No, I'm not, you know, the hell with it. You don't eat that. You skip that meal if there's nothing for you to eat. I'm talking about situations where there's true compulsion, where your existence is threatened. Then I can understand why in a situation of compulsion like that, you might make morally wrong choices. And that, you know, and that doesn't mean what you did is okay. What you did was morally wrong, but your moral culpability is mitigated. So that's what I talk about when I talk about justification and excuse.
And there are shades of gray because we live in a world that's surrounded by animal products and the appliances and the vehicles, and the world we live in is coated and filled with skins and liquids and things from animals.
Right. But still, you can choose. We're talking on computers right now.
Yes.
My guess is that the screen that I'm looking at you on probably has some animal byproduct.
Right.
I mean, may not, but may. There's nothing I can do about that.
Right.
There's nothing. I mean, I drive on roads that have, you know, tarmac that has, you know, bovine blood in it, but we can't get, we're killing 80 billion land animals and a trillion sea animals at least every year. I mean, you know, these slaughterhouse byproducts are cheap. And so they're all over the place. However, we can draw a distinction between indirect participation and direct participation. When you are driving on a road, you are participating indirectly in human exploitation, because some humans are always going to be killed in accidents on that road. And you're indirectly sharing in that. When you buy clothes, you are buying item. Whenever you consume anything, Karen, anything at all, mm-hmm. you are participating in an activity in which some humans are injured in the manufacture of products accidentally every single year. Some of them are killed. There's still a difference between buying a pair of jeans when, in fact, you know, last year, 4 people were injured from that company in the production of those jeans, and going and killing those 4 people. There's a difference. And so, yeah, I don't think there's a shade of gray there. What you choose to put in your mouth, or what you wear, or what you use to wash your hair, or whatever, those are all choices that you can make, and that you can make easily, and that you can avoid. And I would also like to say, before anybody says, not you, but one of your listeners says, well, wait a minute, what about people who can't afford to be vegan? That is the biggest load of nonsense. We have a website called howdoigovegan.com, which Anna and I started a few years ago. It's one of the websites. The other main one I have is abolitionistapproach.com. But we started the howdoigovegan.com website. And one of our goals was to produce recipes, cheap, easy recipes for veganism. And we have a ton of them that have been developed actually by a professor of medieval studies in Ireland named Francis McCormick, who's just a wonderful person and a brilliant person. And Francis has developed endless numbers of recipes. We use her recipes. I mean, you know, I mean, she can figure out how to, you know, how to feed a family of, you know, of eight, you know, on $3.40. I mean, you know, it's easy to be a vegan and a healthy vegan. It's very easy to be a healthy vegan. And we need to sort of get away from this idea that, well, poor people can't be. No. Actually, you know, anybody can be a vegan, and people who are limited in, who have limited income, they're as much interested in these issues from a moral and health point of view as anybody else is. And what we need to be doing is helping those people to see that they can. I mean, we've spent a lot of time working on food desert issues. And our most, Anna and I wrote a book called Advocate for Animals. And we have a whole chapter in there about how you advocate in economically deprived areas. And, you know, and the importance of trying to get food choices, because a lot of people don't have cars. So they, you know, they don't have access to, you know, and so we need to be working on that. I have to tell you, when I started working at Rutgers in 1989, I was at the newer campus with law, with the, that time, the law school I was at was, the law schools have now combined. But I was at the Newark Law School, and Newark had no, you couldn't find a fresh vegetable ever. You know, it was impossible. Now Newark has become a real sort of, the plant alternatives are all over the place. And so we need to be helping and supporting that, as we have over the years. And we would call on all animal people to support that sort of stuff, you know, and because it's very, very important that, you know, that people that we have, we recognize this is a justice issue. One of the ways in which we kill Black people is we have them eating fried chicken and all sorts of garbage, so that, you know, a Black person has a lower life expectancy than somebody from a third world country that has a lot of illness, you know, that has a lot of disease. I mean, it's dreadful what we do with poor people in this country. And poor people are primarily Black people, and not always. There's a lot of poor white people, but, and so we can't forget them. But the bottom line is that, you know, racism, food racism is an element of racism.
I have one last question. And that is all of these new processed vegan products.
Yeah, right.
Now, I know how you eat. You're a Joel Fuhrman poster boy plus extraordinaire.
Yeah. Joel, and, Joel forever. Love Joel.
No. I'm totally G-bombed out. Greens, beans, onions, mushrooms, right, cherry seeds, whole foods, minimally processed. But there's a big chunk of people out there that don't know about nutrition, don't care about nutrition, or maybe don't know they should know, don't have the means, whatever. Where are you on the, I know where I am.
I always tell people, stay away from all that. You know, like, vegan food does not mean going to Whole Foods and buying veggie burgers and veggie chicken and all this stuff. And, you know, because that stuff has a high amount of salt, really bad for you. And it's all processed. You get very little nutritional value, and it's very expensive, you know? And so I always tell people, look, fruits, vegetables, grains, beans, seeds, that sort of stuff, which stuff we all eat anyway, just eat more of that stuff and cut out the other stuff. Not only do I not eat that fake meat stuff because it's not good for you, I actually find it, I want to get people away from this idea that they need to have a meat substitute on their plate in order to feel that they're eating. That's part of the problem. Part of the problem is psychological. It's like, if I don't have a tofurkey, it's not Thanksgiving. If I don't have a Boca burger, it's not dinner. And the answer is, that's nonsense. You know, that's complete nonsense. You know, you just need to get away from this idea that animal products are an important part of what's on the plate. And so you got to substitute one thing for another. The answer is, you don't need to substitute anything. Fruits, vegetables, beans, grains, nuts, seeds. That's all you need. I point people to Joel Fuhrman all the time. Joel doesn't promote, you know, I mean, Joel, I've known Joel for 30 years. I mean, I don't think Joel's interested in this issue from a moral point of view. As a matter of fact, I'm pretty sure he's not, actually, but he's interested only from a health point of view. And Joel is right. You can probably eat a small amount of animal products and still be optimally healthy. From a scientific point of view, that's probably true. I mean, I'm not a scientist, I'm not a physician, but that's probably true. And I get very nervous when I hear, vegan physicians say, well, if you eat any animal products, that's gonna start a disease process in your body. The answer is, well, you know, I'm a little skeptical of that, because you can be a vegan and eat a lot of crap. I was a very unhealthy vegan. When, you know, I used to eat a fried stuff all the time. I mean, I weighed 35 pounds more than I weigh now. You know, I mean, I was a really unhealthy vegan in a lot of ways. So I think you can be an unhealthy vegan, but I point people to Joel all the time, because I'm not saying I agree with everything he says, but I think that, you know, he's got the right approach, which is basically every calorie you take in, let it be maximally nutritional for you. And so, you know, I think he's doing a good job. We're working with some people in Britain, Marlene Watson-Terra and Bill Terra. They're you know, yoga people. They're yoga people who are vegans, unlike many other yoga people, but they're also, you know, they're into, you know, into the nutritional issues. And Marlene has something called Macro Vegan, and they have something called the Human Ecology Project, and they're really good on, you know, we work with them, and we're going to be working more with them in the future. They're really good people who are focused on, you know, sensible nutritional issues.
Gary Francione, author of Why Veganism Matters: The Moral Value of Animals. We are out of time.
You need a longer show, Karen. You just need a longer.
I know. Okay. Thanks for joining me. That was Gary Francione, everybody. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. If you have any thoughts, comments, or questions, you know where to find me. I'm at info@realmeals.org. If you're not vegan, I hope you're thinking about moving in that direction. Veganism matters. Next week, we'll be looking at this issue from a poetic point of view. My guest will be Gretchen Primack, whose collection Kind has been re-released by Lantern Books, and it has some new additions to it. The poems are just incredible, and we'll be sharing some of those on the program. Thanks for tuning in today, and remember, have a delicious week.